You're listening to Interviews with Adam. I am your host, Adam Miller, and today we are joined by Paul Borthwick, and he is the author of a new book called Great Commission, Great Compassion. Paul, did I get your name correct?
You sure did. Thanks, Adam.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to talk to us a little bit about this very important topic for this week as we talk about our call to go into all the world and to fulfill a greater commission than we often even think in our kind of often closed off communities. So thank you for being a part of our broadcast.
Glad to be with you.
Why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself? You're a New England native. That's, a lot of the Christian authors that we get on the program are not from New England. They usually move out to the Bible Belt at least at some point during their life or their ministry. But you're here, you're based in New England, and you have a ministry for New England. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your ministry.
Well, I grew up at Tremont Temple Church with my Christian parents. I was a rebellious teenager. I became a Christian when they brought us to another church's youth group, which was a little bit bigger. And much to my surprise, on a youth retreat, I became a follower of Jesus, coming under the conviction of the Holy Spirit and my parents' prayers, of course. And then went on to become a youth pastor at Grace Chapel, studied at Gordon-Conwell, and went on to become missions pastor at Grace Chapel. So I was on Grace Chapel staff from 76 to 98. And then I joined an international leadership development group, but we still do all this from our base here in Lexington. And I've been a part-time or adjunct teacher in the past, off and on, at Gordon-Conwell and at Gordon College. And as I like to tell people who are from New England, I actually studied out west, which is UMass and Amherst. So, we're kind of local people. My wife's actually from Cambridge, so both of us are very much locals.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this book here, Great Commission, Great Compassion. We've talked about the Great Commission back in the spring around our time in Lent, and we were going through the Gospel of John, and we talked about the Great Commission, our call to go out into all the world and to preach the gospel. But what is the really thrust and the foundation of this book here?
Well, it looks both at the Great Commissions, because there's actually five different statements that Jesus makes post-resurrection, before his ascension, and we look at the components of those, as well as the Great Compassion. This is the phrase that I first heard from Dr. Peter Kuzmich at Gordon-Conwell Seminary. He basically says Matthew 25, which is, as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me, is the Great Compassion, which precedes the Great Commission. And his point was that if we're going to teach them to obey all the things I've commanded you in the Matthew 28 Great Commission, that includes the way we treat the homeless, the way we look at the poor, the way we treat the refugee, if you will, the way we treat the naked or the stranger. All those things are all part of living out the Matthew 28 Great Commission.
That's sort of been our theme of discussion for this week, and what we're kind of focusing on is that we're called to something far greater, but it's not something that is separate in and of itself to our commission to go into all the world and make disciples, because we are bearers of the gospel, a gospel of Christ that demands justice, but also is concerned about what is unjust in this world, correct?
Right, and one of the ways to balance it out, somebody helped me with this phrase. They said, your book is about justice and justification. In other words, especially some of our younger college-age friends, they want to stand for justice, to fight against injustice in the world, rescuing prostitutes and helping with child labor laws, stuff like that. But we also have to remember that it's not an either-or proposition. We are called to be, agents of justice in the world, but also we are agents of justice because through Jesus Christ, we have been justified. And so the ultimate justice has already been paid when Jesus died on the cross for us, and we receive that. And we have to include that as part of any teaching we do on the issues of justice, because otherwise it's just, creating human comfort, which is not in itself bad, but it's incomplete. And so it's sort of the argument that's gone on for years and years of social action versus evangelism. You know, the gospel demonstrated, the gospel proclaimed, but we're just trying to rethink it ourselves in this modern era, you know, where we are wrestling with issues of refugees or the issues of immigrants or the issues of homelessness or poverty, because we in the 21st century, we see all these things in a level of proportion that would exceed almost any generation before us. What I mean by that is we get to see things on the news that in the day pre-news media, pre-satellite TV, no one got to see. And how does that cause us to live? And there's actually a little excerpt in the book that talks about living the life of 1 John 3:16-18 in the world of CNN. And that's the place where it says, if you have the world's goods and you see your brother in need and you close your heart, how can God's love abide in you? Well, we see the world's needs in a way that, you know, even the people that wrote the Bible didn't see it because of the fact of how much we see in the world. If the earthquake is happening in Haiti, it's on the news within 4 hours. If there's a flood in West Virginia, you know, we're watching the impact on CNN or BBC or Fox or wherever.
Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind your writing of this book. Like, what was it that gave you a motivation to address this issue that does seem to be very, a kind of a firebrand in our culture today?
Yeah. Well, part of it is because I've been involved for quite a few years with the Urbana Student Missionary Convention, which is InterVarsity's every three-year convention. And the book was at first just proposed as an outline, and then it became more a little bit designed for not young Christians, but younger people. Basically, what do I do with this gospel message? For example, is the only option to obey the Great Commission to become a full-time missionary? Well, the answer is obviously no, but what does it mean to live the Great Commission if I'm, you know, working at Starbucks or if I'm working in the Boston Financial District? And how does that play a part in the way we look at our coworkers and the way we look at our neighbors, the way we look at our friend base? And so it was released for Urbana 2015, specifically as almost like a follow-up tool. You know, now that you've heard all these things about global mission, here's a book that may help you go to the next step.
I think it's really a critical time in our culture for understanding this greater picture of how our call to commission is essentially about being Christ as well to the people that we're trying to reach and representing His standard, His focus. This is coming, as you're talking about, the Great Commission for Great Compassion. All of this comes through our example, which is found in Christ, correct?
Absolutely. That's why the whole premise of the book is we want to go into the world the way Jesus did. You know, we want to see the woman at the well the way Jesus did. We want to see the leper by the side of the road the way Jesus did. And that's a very big challenge because there's all sorts of other messages telling us how we should see these people. And, you know, even the titles we give to people. I mean, we're very exposed because of the world we go into the Middle East, into Boko Haram territory in Nigeria, this kind of thing. We're very exposed to the realities of terrorists. But the reality is, first and foremost, that's a human being created in the image of God who needs to know God's love. And the reason I say it that way is because there once was a terrorist who thought he was serving God by killing Christians. And he had a vision of Jesus on the Damascus Road, and he became the greatest apostle in terms of New Testament evangelists. So, you know, whenever we see even these people that, you know, ISIS and all that, remember the fact that God is able to see something in them beyond anything we can see. And that kind of gives me hope that there is a way for God to turn even the most wicked evils in the world into something for His kingdom.
You know, oftentimes we're approaching this question, it becomes a very controversial issue in our culture because it becomes a pendulum swing all the way to the right or all the way to the left. Have you found that it's difficult to even break into this conversation to have that pendulum draw back towards the middle at all?
Yeah, because there are some that would basically say, you know, first you just got to preach the gospel, then you take care of people. And then you got the other side of the pendulum that says empty bellies have no ears, which means you have to attend to physical need before you attend to spiritual need. But I would say it depends on the relationships we have and the phase of life that they're at and that we're at. Now, speaking to us native New Englanders, we live in a very post-Christian, difficult sometimes to evangelize area. And I would argue that for my neighbors here where I live, they need to see Christ in me before they'll listen to me talk about Christ. And so it's the both and. You know, it might be that I get to share the gospel and have them over to see a Christian movie, but it might be that I start my relationship with them by raking their leaves. And by doing that, I build some credibility. And that's where I think Christians, we need to realize it's not about preaching at people, it's about living with people. And that's the biblical concept of incarnation. It always strikes me that Jesus lived with people for 30 years before he began really preaching and teaching. And sometimes I think it takes a while to earn the right to be heard, especially in an area that calls itself, like our area, post-Christian, and so oftentimes a little bit more hostile.
You know, I think about this. We have this conversation when we're talking about our neighbors who are outside of our family, outside of our community, but we never have this kind of conversation within the family. You know, a father is not going to give something good to his child and say, now, I'm only going to give this to you after you hear this whole sermon, you know.
Right.
You know, we're talking about considering ourselves in the world to be a blessing to this world, that part of what we're called to do here is be salt, which isn't the light aspect. It's simply the salt aspect of touching the world, and that comes with being the light as well, correct?
Yeah, well, one of the chapters in the book is dedicated to the analogy of the five senses, that basically we are supposed to be witnesses in the world. We're supposed to preach. You know, faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of Christ. We're supposed to be the light of the world, and light dispels darkness. So that would be standing maybe for justice or defending the rights of the unborn or something like that. We're supposed to be salt, which is not just for preservation of society, but I like the idea that salt also creates thirst. And evangelist in England said it this way. He says, live your life in such a way so as to raise questions for which Jesus is the only answer. In other words, create a salt, you know, basically let people see an abundant life in you so that they say, I want what he has, or I want what she has. And then we're supposed to be the touch of Christ, which is out of the Matthew 25, you know, the idea that I was hungry and you fed me, naked and you clothed me. And then one very sort of obscure passage in 2 Corinthians 2, it says we are the fragrance of Christ, you know. And I think one of the most significant things to me in researching the book was the reminder that fragrance doesn't always identify itself, but it lingers. And so the way that I treat someone in traffic, even the way, you know, that's a big Boston challenge. The way that I treat someone, you know, when I'm flying on the airplane and I give them the right of way or I help them with their bag, that might not be any verbal exchange, but I might be, you know, basically leaving a fragrance that next time they meet someone who's also a follower of Jesus, people think, well, I've smelled that before. And so if I could diverge for a second to the subject of witness, one thing that really has helped me as a Christian and as a witness is that when I was trained as a younger guy, the idea was that when you witness, you basically have to give people, you know, the Roman road or the four spiritual laws, everything. A true witness presents the whole gospel and brings people to a decision. Well, that's ideal, but not always possible. You know, you're in a 20-minute airplane flight next to somebody, you're sitting on the bus next to somebody, you're having a casual conversation at the coffee machine at your workplace. And what helped me was the idea that we're witnesses. And the reason I say that is because God is the one building the case in the life of the person I'm talking to. And he's calling me in as his witness. And I might not be the only witness, and I might not be the conclusive witness. But I'm just supposed to bear witness to the reality of Christ in me, and then God can do the rest as he proceeds through other witnesses that might come into that person's life. I was on an airplane flight, and I was praying with my friends at CRU, Campus Crusade, to always pray over the seats that you're going to sit next to. And so I prayed over A and B, and I was in seat number C, letter C. And this lady came in. She was very friendly. She sat in A. A guy came in. He was rip-roaring drunk, and he sat in B. And he was profane, and he was saying things out loud, and he was offending flight attendants. He was offending everybody. So finally, in a moment of quiet, because he was so drunk, I said to him, I said, Bob, I'm so happy to be sitting next to you. I'm an evangelical pastor, and I look forward to talking with you for the next 15 hours. We were flying from Hong Kong to Chicago. And you could just see the color go out of the guy's face as if to say, oh, no, you know, I'm stuck next to this guy. But after he sobered up, A and B, we had some good individual conversations about Christianity and what I did and why was I in China and all those other things. And at the end of the flight, each of them independent of the other, the lady in A who was going on to Dayton, Ohio, I think, the guy in B who was now sober but was going back to Chicago, they both said to me independently of the other, my friends back in Dayton, my friends in Chicago will be glad to know we had this conversation because they're praying for me to meet people like you. In other words, they were surrounded at home by evangelical friends who were trying to win them to Christ, and God was just calling me in as a witness in that case. And that's just the way I stay encouraged is I don't ever really know exactly what God's doing in the life of the person I'm talking to or the life of the person I'm serving, but I do know that God's the one at work.
What would you say to people that that raise the argument that people who are so socially conscious, they're only conscious about helping people here on earth, that they're not gospel-minded, that they're not gospel-centered in their efforts to reach out to the community, that they're actually compromising on the gospel? What would you say to people that that come from that vantage point, that look into those who are socially conscious and claim that they're not gospel-centered?
Well, I would say that the teaching of the Bible is fairly clear that any concrete faith demonstrates itself by good works. Good works do not save, and salvation is not just about social justice. But, you know, it says in the book of James, you know, show me your faith without works, I will show you my faith by my works. James says true religion is to care for widows and orphans. I do think that the needs of the world can so overwhelm people sometimes that they get preoccupied with just the needs here. And that's a reminder to all of us that no matter who we're working with in their temporal needs right now, you know, the homeless person, the unemployed, or whoever it is, they also are people with spiritual needs, and we can't separate one from the other. But I think it was Dr. John Stott who said that the gospel and social action are like the two pieces of the scissors, you know, and the only way for the scissors to work properly is if both of them were working in conjunction with each other. And I like that analogy, but there might be others that are more appropriate.
What would you say then, vice versa, to those who are very socially conscious? And it often happens to where they're really focused on one particular social injustice, and they look at others who are not as adamant about that one issue as though they're not concerned with the holistic picture of what we were called to do in the gospel.
Yeah, I think that the danger whenever you get onto one specific issue or you're really dedicated to, you know, the liberation of kids from the work, you know, child labor and that kind of thing, is that you can easily become a little bit pharisaical about it. And, you know, if you're not into what I'm into, then you're not as good of a Christian type of thing. And I would just say, basically, people are one into work, you know, to work on causes or to work on against needs. They're more one into it by being invited to join than being condemned for not being involved in it. Because one of the things that I realized, because, like I said, we do a lot of global traveling, and that just adds such a magnitude of proportion to the need. For like, if someone tells me about the homeless in Boston, that's almost minuscule compared to the homeless in Calcutta or the homeless in Mexico City. And so, it's easy just to say, well, my compassion's bigger than your compassion. And I think the best thing to do is basically say, realize that God's big and all of us might be dedicated in a certain area. Everybody should be looking for some area to make a difference in, but we can't possibly do it all.
I think about this issue in the context of when I first started in my ministry. I was as an intern at a church. I was asked to work in the nursing home as part of my internship. And if you had asked me to work in a nursing home, I probably would have said, no, it's not right for me. But I really kind of grew into that ministry and really loved it. And I did it for 4 years while I was really in my early training and early progress in ministry. But whenever I'd invite people to come with me, I'd always say, come once, come twice. It might not be right for you, but if God really captures your heart for these people, they definitely need they need help and they need service. I think that that's, you said inviting people into the thing that we're passionate about. That can often, even if it's something that you don't think that you're going to be excited about, oftentimes just doing the work of the ministry can be a pretty exciting, enticing atmosphere to want to do more, correct?
Yeah, and to be candid, sometimes this is where one of the best outcomes of short-term missions, people who might never be long-term missionaries go to a place like in Haiti or someplace else in a needier, physically needier area of the world, and their hearts are just, broken open there, and they come home and they start to become more compassionate where they live, So I remember years ago one of the teams from our youth ministry at Grace went down and did work in an orphanage specifically for hearing impaired children, so deaf and hearing impaired otherwise, and the students there were so moved by that, several of them came home and started a deaf ministry at their own high school, because they had seen it, and basically your heart gets soft, and you hold a child. You see a need. You see a need relieved. People who have worked in the past with Habitat for Humanity, as to whether or not how deep they go Christian-wise is another question. But when they see a homeless person get the keys to their first home, it just changes it changes the builder's life, because they actually said, "I can make a difference. For this one, I can make a difference." And that's, I think, the most challenging thing with world need. Is that we don't get overwhelmed by it so that we do nothing.
It's a great reminder of our call to the Great Commission and to have great compassion. Paul, it has been such a privilege to talk with you about your book. We've been talking with Paul Borthwick about his book, Great Commission, Great Compassion, Following Jesus and Loving the World. Thank you for giving us some insight and some inspiration to go out and to be Christ to the people who desperately need a hope in this world.
And thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff, and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace. From Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.